out of it. Somehow Wyatt's not by me, but I was distracted. Cam, not so lucky. I saw him coming.
He could not hide. All right, let me look here. A topic. She's not here. You didn't send me a topic.
I did.
What'd you send me?
I actually sent you two.
You did?
Yeah.
Oh, you never decided. That's what it was.
I did. You told me through South Africa, but you told me in person.
Okay. Apartheid.
Yeah, or the Oslo Accord.
Right, that was your other choice.
Yeah.
Right, but you're going to do the apartheid one, right?
Yeah, because you said I couldn't vote.
Yeah. Apartheid. Okay, cool. All right, whoa. All right, Ashley's here. Hey, come here. Yeah. Well, if you're going to give everyone a handshake, at least get to give me one, too.
Of course.
All right, thank you, my friend. I appreciate it. It's only fair. All right, so now Trevor came in, too. I got the back corner all set, pretty sure, because she's not going to... Oh, you're here. You're back. Hi. Yes, you.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm spectacular. Thank you for asking. I appreciate your sincere concern about my well-being. See, Tyler, he wouldn't care. He wouldn't care at all. But I appreciate that you do. Alright, so we got this Portuguese thing going on.
In which the Portuguese are doing the same thing the Spanish are. Give or take at around the same time. Except obviously we know they're going different directions. Columbus went this way. Portuguese went this way. But of course in place the church passed them. Treaty of Tordesillas, which basically said everything here is Portuguese, everything there is Spanish. So we have no treaty violations going on. But we know Vasco da Gama made it all the way over to Calicut, and he found stuff. Lots of stuff. Tons of stuff. With a small little bag of silver coins, he managed to procure enough goods to pay for the expedition 60 times over, making him suddenly one of the wealthiest people in Europe. But of course, don't forget, he didn't get it all. Him and his crew got 80%, because the crown got 20, because that was the Portuguese deal going all the way back to the time of Prince Henry. But now, Portuguese has it. So almost immediately, upon the return of the first expedition, the crown organizes a second. 1500, Pedro Cabral departs from Lisbon with a larger fleet, 13 ships, and he is basically told to get more. That's the first thing. You got 13 ships. Gama only had 4. He got 13. Get more. Obviously, there's more silver that was sent with him. But Cabral is also told to open up trade relations. Because the crown realizes there's money to be made in being the courier. What's a courier? Yeah, exactly. Like UPS. He wants to be the carrier. He doesn't want to raise the spices and the silks and all the other luxury items. He doesn't want to have to run a store. No. He wants to simply get it from A and get it to you, because then you'll buy it from him.
Money to be made is being the middleman. But, interestingly enough, Cabral makes a mistake.
He sails out, hits Cape Verde, and instead of hugging back in a southeasterly manner, he continues to go a little too far
to the west, but lo and behold, he eventually hits ground. Instead of, however, discovering a new island like he believed, he actually planted the flag in the name of the Brazilian king, sorry, Portuguese king, claimed what he thought was an island for his state. Of course, we know today what he ended up discovering was Brazil. FYI, if you know any Brazilians, what language do they not speak?
Spanish.
Yeah, unlike the rest of the New World, they don't speak Spanish. They speak Portuguese. All right. But here's the thing. Cabral thought it was an island, and he really didn't spend much time there trying to figure it out because he had a mission to engage in, to get to here, make trade relations, and make lots of money. But the following year is when another interesting trip occurred. In 1501, on board another Portuguese ship was a cartographer. What's a cartographer?
Make maps.
Make maps, exactly. By the name of Amerigo Vespucci. Now, history suggests that Vespucci actually made the transatlantic trip four times. But there's no physical, tangible proof of his first or his fourth trip. We do know his second trip because there is evidence that survived. He actually sailed on a Spanish ship. But on his third trip, he happened to sail for the Portuguese. So it's the third trip, ultimately, that becomes the most famous. Because when he gets back on this expedition, and basically the goal of this expedition was to get around here, or at least try to figure out how big this place was, he wrote a letter to a friend in which he described what he observed. And in the letter, and by the way, we only know this because his letters were collected and later published in a book. In the letter to his friend, he makes a bold claim. And by the way, at the time, men of letters wrote in Latin. So this letter happened to be in Latin. And in the letter to his friend, he basically asserts that Columbus, who was still alive at this time, and somewhere on between his third and his fourth trip over, but Vespucci boldly states Columbus is an idiot. Columbus is wrong. That Columbus, in fact, did not discover a route to Asia. Because he realized that Cabral's island was not an island, but in fact a continent. Part of what Vespucci described as mundus novus, a new world. And this new world was definitely not Asia. Now, here's the thing. Later on, when Vespucci's story would be published, he signed his name as a legitimate testimony, saying that his words were true. And he signed it in Latin. Americus Vespucius. But the printer, for whatever reason, instead of using the masculine, Americus, assigned him the feminized version of his name, America, and applied that to this mundus novus, this new world. So when the book was published, his story essentially is the first recognized use of the word America, naming this new place. So, as all of you are, as I'm sure I am, proud to live in America. Remember, it's not America's because of a typo, which makes America even better. Because I don't know if I'd be excited to say America's. But that's history, folks. Weird tangent. But interesting. That's what history is all about, interesting stuff. Questions? All right. Now, by the way, according to rumor, not only did Vespucci cover most of the coast, but apparently on one expedition, he was amongst one of the first people to walk all the way across the Isthmus of Panama and actually see the Pacific. But again, that's legend. Yes.
Yeah. I wanted to find out deeper about America as a meaning.
Meaning?
Yeah.
It's just a feminized version of his name. It means nothing else. That's it?
Boring, huh? You know what would have sounded better? North and South Vespucci. I like that more. I'm Italian. I like that. Vespucci. But hey, we got America, and it is what it is. All right, so while that was going on, Cabral continued to make his way over to Calicut. Following, once he did his course correction, almost the identical path of Da Gama, including skipping all of the bad Muslim ports and going to the good Muslim ports, including the port of Malindi, where, just like with Da Gama, the Sultan gave him a pilot, and the pilot would help steer across the Indian Ocean, helping him to arrive in Calicut. When Vespucci arrives, he has with him letters of order, you know, formal documents coming from the crown, outlining what he was tasked to do, I'm sure through translation. The leader of the city, a man who had a position called a Zamorin, not that you need to remember that, I'm sure was appreciative of the fact that he's an official envoy of a king. And apparently they treated one another with respect, and they managed to negotiate rights to establish what at the time was called a factory. Now, by the way, the factory... The word factory in the 16th century does not mean what you think it means today in 2024. What do we think of when we see the word factory today?
Like building stuff or creating things?
Where?
Like in this big building.
Good. So it's a production center. So you're going to make something in a bigger building. Well, back then, the word actually referred to what today we might call like a trading post. It was called a factor because the commanding officer was a factory because the commanding officer was a factor. And what the job of the factor was to go out and get stuff and bring it to the big building, where it would be housed. So usually a factory was fortified. There were soldiers there. There were some type of defenses. Maybe you put an outer wall around it. But the idea was, is you bring the outsiders in, you exchange goods, and they take your goods and leave, allowing you to begin stockpiling quantities of items. The factory would operate whether or not there were actually ships in port. So the idea is you start slowly building up your inventory, and soon ships are going to be constantly coming back and forth, taking a little bit of the stores, putting on the ship, sailing away. Coming back, bringing more stuff, taking more stuff. So, unlike a modern factory where stuff are built, there's still stuff comes in one door,
stuff goes out the other. It's the same basic idea. But this would allow them, instead of constantly having to shop when the ships come in, they can constantly be on the lookout for good deals. Also in there, not only is there a warehouse, not only are there defenses, but there's also lodgings. Because you're going to leave a group of soldiers there, or security, to protect the goods. Unfortunately, or fortunately, we'll start with the positive first. If you do good exchange, good negotiation, good trades, everyone's going to know where your factory is, and they're going to want to come to you and do business. The problem is that if you're doing good business with some, you're probably going to upset others. This first factory only successfully operated for about 2 months. When, for some reason or another, a group of Muslims living in Calicut, angered by the fact that these Christians were doing business, attacked the factory, set it on fire, burned it to the ground. Why? Don't know exactly. Could it have been religion? Impossibly. But chances are these were just merchants that wanted to wipe out competition. But long story short, in the chaos, Cabral would actually lose 60 men. Some of them were burned alive. And Cabral himself barely made it to the docks to get on board the ships and sail out into the harbor. Well, while out in the harbor, Cabral would send word to the Zamorin demanding justice. But guess what the city governor did? I have no idea who these people are. I have no police. I have very limited soldiers. It's a crime. I can't do anything about it. So no justice for Cabral. But he was pissed. So you know what he decides to do? He opens fire on the city. Why? Well, his ships had cannon on it. And then, after he opened up on the city, and parts of the city start catching on fire. They didn't shoot explosive shells, by the way, back then. They were cannonballs. But as the cannonballs, you know, went into houses, I'm sure they knocked over candles and torches. And long story short, eventually fires would break out. People would die. But then Cabral sat on his deck of his ship, waiting for them to fire back. And you know what never happened? That. Not a single shot came back in retaliation. Which made him realize something. Military superiority. He has a tactical advantage. He has artillery. And the city does not. Yes.
Why did the Muslims attack again?
Don't know. I wasn't being facetious. Historically, we don't know. All we know is the record identifies them as being Muslims. So it could have been jihad. It could have been religion. Or it could have just been economics. Well. Now Cabral is licking his chops. If I have a cannon and I point it at your head, what are you likely going to do for me? Why?
Because you're afraid.
Oh, you don't want to get blown up.
That makes sense.
This would be a huge, significant game changer in Portuguese strategy. One, they know they have nothing of value that they produce at home that the Asians want. So they have to use silver. Which means, of course, they're going to have to get into the slave trade and start making silver so that way they can buy stuff. But now, two,
if for some reason they can't get into a place, they can use the direct threat of force. And there's no return fire. This is brilliant because for the first time, documentation in Portugal appears when Cabral gets back, suggesting that we can flex our money. So we're a tiny, tiny little country on the western tip of the Iberian Peninsula, halfway around the world. But this tiny little country has big guns. And if we flex our muscles, we can get whatever we want. Huge. And coincidentally, from this point onward, for the next several hundred years, the Western Europeans would use the combination of the two. Using gold or silver to buy what they wanted, and if they can't buy what they want, they use military intimidation. Huge shift in Western civilization. But here's the most amazing thing, because we don't care about what's going on in Europe. No. We care about global history. And the truth of the matter was that there is no primary source from Calicut that discusses the arrival of either Da Gama or Cabral. The archivist there didn't record it. It was nothing. It was so insignificant. It would be like you walking into an airport one day and getting on a flight and flying somewhere, or you going to a bus stop or a train station. You, insignificant in the grand scheme of the daily or weekly or yearly operations of these major hubs. Do you ever just walk down the street of a busy city? Is anyone paying attention to you?
Unless you deal with something crazy, right?
Yeah, then you become like TikTok famous. For Cabral, Da Gama, this was a huge turning point. But for the Asians, these were just another people that arrived on boats looking to do business. Just another customer. Now, why was the case? Well, this is why. Unbeknownst to the Portuguese, they didn't just arrive in one little country and visited one little port and did business with one small group of merchants. No. What they did was entered a vast trading network that literally stretched from the east coast of Africa up into the modern Middle East, all the way across India, the subcontinent, into the Pacific, as far north as Korea and Japan. A vast trading network, yes.
Completely random. I'm just wondering if, like, since earlier you said factory meant something different, did the word network exist but to mean that specifically?
No, I'm using a modern phrase to describe what this was. An interconnected network. Because as you can see, you have overlapping trading routes that crisscross and intersect, linking the African, the Middle Easterners, the Indians, the Persians, the Southeast Asians, the Indonesians, the Filipinos, the Chinese, the Koreans, the Japanese, all of these historically ancient civilizations all linked together. Doing business. And they're not buying and selling, they're trading. You produce fruit, I produce wood. How much fruit can I get from you for my wood? There's no markets, there's no stock markets, there's no corporations.
There are individuals getting goods, bringing them somewhere else, exchanging them for other goods before continuing onward. As I told you, when the Portuguese arrived in Calicut, to their shock, they were able to get anything that they could imagine. Because the goods that could be found in the markets in Calicut came as far away as Africa and Korea and every place in between. On any given day, there were sailing ships going back and forth from port to port, just bringing goods to new markets. It was larger, vaster. Why are we going backwards? Don't touch the screen, Lemanic. Than the famed Silk Road. It stretched thousands of miles, and it had been in operation for hundreds of years. The earliest traces predate even the Crusades. So, when a couple of ships with a couple of hairy-faced, smelly, lighter-skinned dudes appeared, it's just another group. It's no big deal.
All right, let's give you something tangible to know. All right, the easiest way to do this is to focus on what this is and what it's not. This is a network that connects three major zones. China, one major zone. India, another major zone. And of course, Africa, another major zone.
From those major zones came significant commodities from China. Porcelain. You know what porcelain is? Anyone not know what porcelain is? It's like fine ceramics. Paper. Silk. Those are the major exports that came out of China. In India, cotton. Cotton and tea were the major commodities produced in India.
Of course, out of Africa
came things like ivory and wood, even livestock.
So how did all the stuff end up in Calicut? Well, very simple. A ship would depart from China, full of Chinese goods. But the merchant wanted to be able to make as much money as possible. So the merchant would go from China and maybe stop down in Indonesia, where he might trade some Chinese paper or some Chinese silk for different spices. So he'd pick up some of that commodity, and then he would go onward to another place, pick up other spices, maybe get coffee. And eventually he would make his way over to Calicut, where he would unload the Chinese stuff, the Indonesian things, anything he picked up on the way. And then he would fill his ship up with commodities that came from as far away as Africa. Ivory, wood, you had rich rugs and tapestries from the Persian Gulf. Coffee also came from the Persian Gulf. Other things. So just as you got one merchant going this way, you got another merchant coming this way. They'd meet in the middle and then they'd bring the goods back and forth.
The broadest demand and the highest prices were those spices. Because after all, who wants to eat just bland food?
But you could get rice, you could get beef, chicken, pork, you name it. Timber, gems, anything. Either from the big places or from the places in between. Now here's the thing. The Chinese and the Arabs largely did most of the sailing, but they shared technology. So unlike the Europeans, which had ocean-going ships, the majority of the Arab and Chinese ships had to kind of hop along the coastlands. But the Chinese had the compass, which was something the Europeans did not. But long story short, this had been flowing. Everybody had been making money, and everybody was happy. Questions?
What is the blue line?
This is a major colonization route from Madagascar. Because what would happen is once the Portuguese came in and started operating in Madagascar, they actually encouraged some of their colonists when they took over Indonesia to migrate.
Good question. Other questions? Yes.
I have to go.
Okay.
Is that okay?
Do I have a choice?
No. I sent you an email.
Oh, when did you send it to me?
This morning.
I didn't see it.
Sorry.
Do you have a game?
Yeah.
Well, don't be late.
Okay.
Send me a topic. You owe me a topic for your paper.
Okay.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Score lots of baskets. Bring back a win.
I will.
Hoorah, go AmCats.
Yeah.
All right. Right, the girls are still called AmCats too, right?
Yeah.
All right, I just didn't know if there was like a boys team and a girls team. A woman's team, men's team. All
right, now here's the catch. I gave you the gist. We kind of understand what's going on. But here's the most interesting thing. In addition to everything I described, the Portuguese almost immediately picked up on two vital, important characteristics that they could use to exploit this thousands and thousands of miles of economic exchange. The first was that everything operated with, shake my hand, everything operated with gentlemen's agreements, handshakes. There were no contracts. There were no courts. If I came and you had what I wanted and I had what you wanted, we negotiated and figured out quantities that we both could walk away with and be happy. So as a result, the focus on profit was of the highest order. But there was no prince, there was no king, there was no government. Which meant it was kind of a free-for-all. So if the Portuguese were clever, they could take control by playing some against others, dividing and conquering. And two, not only was there no control, there was also no military presence. Because everyone wanted something. It was peaceful. It's funny. The least divisive thing that we all can agree on is how cool this is. And I think we all agree that we would all be happy if we had more of this than we did. And I think we all agree, if someone could get it so you could get more of this, you'd be okay with it, right?
the Muslims and the Hindus and the Chinese and the Indonesians and all of the different ethnic groups. They didn't care about race. They didn't care about religion. Their focus was business. So there was no need to have police. Because if you went into a market and you screwed someone over, you'd get a reputation. And then no one would want to do business with you again. So, if the Portuguese could come in with their big guns, flex their muscles, throw their weight around, who's going to stop them? Because here's the real truth of the matter. If I want your money, and I'm going to put a gun to your head, do I care if you like me? No. Because guess what I'm going to do when I come back? Exact same thing. So, the irony was when the Portuguese came back, and they kept coming back, they didn't play by the informal rules under which the Asian trade network had been operating for centuries. They didn't care about handshakes, gentlemen's agreements. They wanted stuff. And they were prepared to do anything to get it. For as cheap as possible. Questions? But now here's the kicker. Desperate times call for desperate measures. It's one thing to say I got a ship and I got cannon on it, and I'm suddenly going to walk in and I'm going to take control of a trade network that's thousands of miles in long, involves every single major kingdom and empire on that half of the earth, and encompasses millions of people. Yeah, one thing, I'm going to take it all over. Yep. But the truth of the matter is the Portuguese had problems. They just didn't see it. The biggest problem they had was, in order to be successful, they had to use the one thing that they had little of. Gold and silver. The Asians didn't want any of their stuff. So they would have to use gold and silver. But where are they going to get gold and silver from? Well, we touched upon it last class.
America.
Yeah, the Portuguese are going to have to get gold and silver from America. But who controls where all the gold and silver are?
Spanish.
Is the Spanish just going to give the gold and silver to the Portuguese? No. What are the Portuguese going to need to do to get the gold and silver from the Spanish? What? Oh, I don't think the Portuguese can be able to conquer the Spanish. Trade, okay. So, what do the Portuguese have that the Spanish need?
Slaves.
Oh, yeah. How do the Portuguese get slaves? That's right, they already made the deals with the African chiefs. So the Portuguese literally had to make a deal with the proverbial devil. They had to engage in the transportation of human beings. Take it from one group who didn't want them and get them to a group that did. For exploitation. And what would the Spanish pay to get those laborers? You're right, but what would the Spanish be willing to pay to get the laborers to make their mercantilist empire profitable?
Gold and silver.
They'll pay that gold and silver. Exactly. And was it cheap?
Yeah.
No. I'm not exaggerating. By all the statistical analysis that I read, the approximate value of a slave, even back then, was the equivalent of a $70,000 car today. They weren't cheap. So the Spanish were willing to pay the highest prices to get laborers to make their mercantilist empire profitable. The Portuguese would then take that gold and silver, put it on boats, and send it over to Asia. Because the Asians don't want African slaves. They have plenty of their own slaves. But they want that silver stuff in particular that has mystic properties. But of course, there's a catch. There's a catch. Mercantilism is based on our sense of money. Not the Asian sense of fair trade, but the Western European sense of money. The crown wants to get more land so he can get more resources, so he can make more money, which would allow the crown to get more. But here's the catch. If the crown is going to make money in the slave trade, and then takes that money and puts it on a boat and sails it halfway around the world, is the crown getting any stronger? No, definitely not in the short term. Because what could potentially happen to the ship that has the chest of silver and gold sailing halfway around the earth? It could disappear. Exactly. And then what happens? So if the crown takes all the money it makes and pumps it into this attempt to get more money, they potentially could run out of money. Which means instead of getting stronger, the crown's going to get weaker. To make matters worse, our ships got to stop at some of the Muslim towns, even though they're friendly. Has to buy new wood to fix your ships, has to buy new food, has to buy fresh water. The more ships you send over there, the more the Muslims are going to start making money. And what the heck was the whole reason we circumnavigated Africa to begin with? To avoid the Muslims. Now we're going to do business with them. And if the Muslims get stronger, they can continue to harass us in the Mediterranean. They can unleash their pirates. Or, in the case of the Ottomans, they can continue to march up the Balkans, heading towards Austria. So ultimately, this is the reason why the Portuguese decided, never mind this calculation, this is bad math. The cheapest way to do it is just use force. Because they couldn't do it the other way. There was not a good outcome. No, the hell is next to me. Questions? All right. So, the Portuguese did have one kind of advantage, if you want to call it an advantage. Even though they had very few actual soldiers, one of the advantages that the Portuguese had was that there was no class division. For the most part, the nobles and the commoners were not fighting against one another. Both classes seemed to embrace this idea for opportunity. The commoners were excited by a chance to make money, and the nobles were excited with a chance to make more money.
So, because you had this unity of cause, the Portuguese were able to overcome their small numbers by presenting a united front. Now, FYI, the same is not true today. The only time in my lifetime when I've seen the United States actually united in a single cause was on September 12th, 2001. It was the only time in my lifetime. There were no Democrats, there were no Republicans. Everybody was joined together in angry at the Muslim terrorists who knocked down the World Trade Center. It was so bizarre. Of course, the Democrats screwed it up like 2 or 3 days later when they began criticizing George W. Bush, and then politics started all over again. But we had a day or two, and it was a beautiful thing. Prior to that, probably December 7th, 1941, when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. The reason being is human beings by nature are divided. We have our opinions, we have our interests, we have our desires. So the fact that the Portuguese were on the same page about this is a huge advantage they had. Because there would be no sympathy for the other side because of the goal. Let's make money. And they put it to work right away. The third major Portuguese expedition was Da Gama's second, which was launched shortly after Cabral came back. After learning what Cabral went through, Da Gama went with a larger military capability than either he had on his first expedition or Cabral had on his. So, when he returned in 1502, he didn't go in nice trying to negotiate. Everywhere he went with the threat of force. And made cities pay tribute to him as he went. So he stops in some of the Muslim ports on the eastern coast of Africa. He's not going to go in there and play nice. He says, give us fresh water or we're going to blow you up. Give us fresh timber so we can fix our ship or we're going to blow you up. Give us food or we're going to blow you up. And port after port submitted because no one in their right mind wanted to get blown up. He also actually opened fire on those places that refused to cooperate, killing hundreds. The next Portuguese group came, then the next one, and then the next one. Over the next almost 10 years, soon the Africans, the Indians, they came to be fearful of the arrival of these Portuguese. They weren't just some other group of people looking to do business. They were thugs. But what eventually happens to bullies? Yeah. By 1509, started off first among some of the ports in the Persian Gulf, where Egyptians seemingly joined forces with Indians, they began pushing back. They began resisting. And even though the Portuguese had the cannon, the one thing the Portuguese had the ability to do is to actually land in a harbor where when they pulled in, all of the area was surrounded by guys with swords and spears ready to kill them if they set foot on their soil. So now they thought they had everything figured out. But at first you don't succeed. Try again. So by the 1510s and 1520s, the Portuguese began to change their tactics. They realized that direct attacks did not work because eventually the people are going to push back. So instead, what they decided to do was take advantage of the fact that they have ocean-going ships. Instead of trying to bully every single little port along the way, what they began doing was capturing strategic points along the trade routes and building actual fortifications. I'm going to sweep back to the map because I realize I don't think I have maps going on these pages, and I wish I did. There we go. The Portuguese, for example, would take over the small little port of Hormuz, would completely fortify it, making it a Portuguese stronghold capable of firing back on the land if any of the natives tried attacking them. Out of Hormuz, they would sail their ships and they would begin harassing any vessel trying to leave the Persian Gulf. They would do the same thing over here near the Indian village of Goa. Why? Well, because there were sea routes that went around the modern little island of Sri Lanka, although then it was called Ceylon. So they began harassing ships that were going this way. And then even later, they seized control of Malacca, the southern tip of Malaysia. Same thing. Any Chinese ship, any vessel, try going through the straits, the Portuguese ships would sail out and intercept them. Almost like police. And that they would demand tribute, payment, to be able to sail onward to the next destination. The Portuguese realized, if I can't control everything, we could take control of key points and essentially put up like toll plazas, toll booths, and charge for the right of safe passage. Eventually, they would begin focusing on key commodities that went through those narrow passes. And they began basically charging licensing fees. Oh, so you want to bring nutmeg through our sea pass? Well, you got to pay the right for the right to be able to do that. They started trying to take over the operational and distribution of these certain products. Because they started realizing, like we said way at the beginning, being the middleman is more important than actually producing it. If they could, for example, take control over nutmeg or cinnamon, locally produced spices that grew in few places, they had larger profit potentials. And this ultimately would become known as the Portuguese system. Control key locations and control the distribution of certain, only certain products through those key locations. If you could do that, then you could bring some of those commodities to other places and essentially gain entry, not to the ports, but to the flow of the goods themselves. But here's the problem. Here's the biggest problem. And it took the Portuguese a long time to figure it out. Where does things like cinnamon and nutmeg and pepper and cloves, where do they come from? Where do spices come from? From what in India? And at the time, they didn't come from India. They came from the islands. Eventually, they would be relocated to India. But where do they come from? Plants. So here's the thing. You're going to try to get a monopoly over something that grows from a plant. How are you going to take control over the production of something that comes from a plant? Explain it to me. How would you do it? So you're going to get into the harvesting business. Why not? If you get into the harvesting business, then you know what's going to be produced, yeah?
Yeah. So, yes.
Okay, so you're going to harvest. All right. How many laborers are you going to get?
Would need a lot.
Where are you going to get them from? Because remember, you're operating on the other side of the earth. Well, you are the Portuguese. You're not going to be able to get other Portuguese because the other Portuguese are on the other side of the earth. So who are you going to have to get as laborers? Okay, so do you really want to get into the harvesting game? No, probably not, because there's a lot to deal with that, right? You just want to be able to distribute it. So you got to let probably the locals harvest it. Well, the locals going to want to do business with you?
Probably not.
Why not?
Because they don't want to work for you.
Right. So now that's a problem, right?
Yeah.
So how are you going to overcome it?
Pay.
Okay, you're going to pay, but if you pay them, where are you going to get the money from?
Selling the spices.
Okay, so you're going to give them part of your profit.
Yeah.
Okay, where do the spices come from again? What type of object do spices come from? Plants. Okay. What happens if the locals all of a sudden decide you're not paying them enough and decide not to plant their plants where you can find them? You know how many islands are in Indonesia? Thousands. So if you're the Portuguese and you want to control the production of a certain product that comes from a plant, that you have to buy it from a farmer, but you're not going to give the farmer what he wants, the farmer is simply not going to plant the plant where you thought the farmer was and going to go somewhere else and probably do business with somebody else. Can you stop it? No, what are you going to have to do to try to find the farmer when he moves? How are you going to find him, though, to threaten him? So you're going to have to get more ships. And you have to get more sailors. Which is going to cost what? More of? And where are you going to get that money from?
That's going to be tough.
Again, what do I have up there? Unsustainable. I'm not being mean to you. This is this type of stuff that the Portuguese started going through over the next few decades. They tried saying, oh, I'm going to take control of everything. The problem is, how can you take control of the production of a plant when if it has to grow here, you can simply uproot it and move it over here where the Portuguese are, and then do business with the Muslim and one of the Chinese, because maybe they're going to pay more money than the Portuguese did. So the only thing the Portuguese do is they have to get more soldiers. But where are they going to get more soldiers? On the
the other side of the earth, which costs money, which they don't have. They were literally spinning their wheels trying to control something that was uncontrollable. And in the end, the Portuguese mercantilist system was the first one to fail because it was unsustainable. They could not control the flow of goods that came from plants. And as a result, competition was able to break through. But that was great for the next round of Europeans who came in. The Dutch, the English, the French, they would come in and try improving upon the system that was made by the Portuguese. But of course, realizing the mistakes. So as we will see, oh wait, that's it? An hour? I thought it was longer than that. We go to 1:30, right? What the Portuguese, where they failed, was that they could not maintain control of what they wanted to control. So what would the Dutch and the English do? They would come in and not try to control everything. And ultimately, that's what will allow them to become successful. Questions? All right. A little more, then we'll call it a day. What did the later European nations do in Asia? Well, they did kind of like a hybrid. They saw what the Spanish were able to do in the New World. They saw the goods and the bads, the pros and the cons. And then they saw what the Portuguese did. Same thing, pros and cons. And they essentially would try to do a combination of both to maximize their profits in the Asian trade network. And by the way, the Europeans would be trying to take over the Asian trade all the way up until World War I. And they still were never able to do it all. They tried. And here's how they did it. They realized they didn't have the strength to conquer China or India or the Middle East or Africa. So what they decided to do is focus on the areas where they had the greatest advantage, the sea. They wouldn't try to establish empires like the Spanish did, but no. What they would do is attempt to use their superior naval technology to get the goods into the marketplaces. Instead of using armies, use the Benjamins. Because if I can get you addicted to the product that I want to sell you because you need it, I'm going to control you. Probably more effective than if I put a gun to your head. Because you're going to want to buy my product as opposed to being forced into doing business with me. So what the Europeans ultimately would do is they would have to become educated. They would have to figure out how to use the system to their advantage. One of the best examples that I can give you was kowtowing. Can someone tell me what kowtowing is?
Is it like a really quick attack to kill somebody instantly?
Nope. Ah. Kow, wait, isn't it?
swearing allegiance falsely and then attacking them?
No.
Dang it.
Kowtowing is a Chinese practice of humiliating oneself in front of a perceived superior. So, what the Europeans figured out was that the local kings or chiefs viewed themselves as being all-powerful. So, you're not going to go in there and you're not going to be adversarial. You're not going to go in there and say, well, I'm a European Christian and I'm better than you. Because they're going to dismiss you. Which means no business. So instead, you're going to play the game. So, one of the most important things to do is if you ever went before the Son of Heaven, the Chinese Emperor, was that you never in a million years approached the throne. Even if the Emperor called you forward. You were not allowed to get an eye shot. You had to always stay far away. But the first thing you do when you enter the room is you get down on the ground on your hands and knees and you literally put your forehead on the ground. This is kowtowing. And you sit there. You sit there. You do not move until the emperor's advisor said, you can come a little closer. And then you prostrate yourself. You never look up. You always look down the ground. You treat yourself like you are a beggar in the presence of God. And my father told me, always look another man in the eye, and you always shake his hand with a firm handshake. I could never imagine groveling before anybody. But if you want to do business in the emperor, in the emperor's realm, that's the game you got to play. If you got to act the fool, you act the fool. You do whatever is necessary to get the deal done. And the Europeans figured these out. And soon, they were willingly kowtowing or humbling themselves to get the deal. Now, on the islands, that's a different story. Because on land, you're dealing with powerful, long-existing empires. But in the islands, you're dealing with more primitive tribal structures. So ironically, the Europeans would be very successful in taking over the islands. For example, the Dutch would eventually come and conquer Ceylon, which is that little teardrop island off the coast of India. That's where cinnamon came from. Within 100 years of their arrival, the Dutch managed to establish a full monopoly on cinnamon production. They literally would make deals with the local chieftains and take control of the whole island, and the chief would allow them to control the distribution of all the product from the island. They did so by doing business. And by the way, it was the Dutch who also discovered coffee beans. Very powerful, rich coffee beans that were native to the island of Java. Which is where that delicious drink gets its nickname from. And they would do the same thing. Make a deal with the local chieftain, stay good friends with the chieftain, eventually be granted more and more rights because they were willing to humiliate themselves for the chieftain. They also, and this will be the final point, would also build something similar with the natives that the Spanish had. The Encomedia. Europeans were granted rights over large tracts of land by the local chieftains
And then the Europeans would allow the native villagers who lived in those places to stay, in exchange for them giving a portion of their crop to first the Portuguese, later the Dutch. Because they interfered little in the day-to-day lives for the natives, it was no different than it was before the Europeans came. But the tribute was paid, the tribute would be put on ships and sail to other places in the Asian trade network. And this is ultimately what would allow the indigenous people to harvest indigenous crops for greater distribution. Questions? All right, when we come back, we're going to look at a couple other factors, and that's going to be it for the test. So, here's a question for you, and I will let you decide because I don't care. I see you on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Would you like to have your first exam on a Friday, a Saturday, a Sunday, or a Monday? Doesn't matter to me.
It's during the class period?
No.
Or is it just like all day?
It will be all day. So I'll open the exam online. So I'll open the exam up at 8 o'clock in the morning. I'll give you to like midnight to do it. But I'll let you guys vote and decide what day the exam is going to be on. Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it'll be an hour.
Probably Friday or Saturday.
How many people would want to have the exam on a Friday? How many people would like to have it on a Saturday? How many people would like to have it on a Sunday? How many people would like to have it on a Monday? All right, well, it looks like we'll have it on Saturday. Perfect, that was easy. I'm fair. Let you guys get to decide your own fate. I'll talk more about the exam next class. Any other questions? Yes?
The best way to study would just be through your website, right?
Go through the notes. Listen to the lectures. Use the outlines as a guide like David does.
Second question. Where do I rehear the lectures on your website?
Proflamanic.com, yeah. In the audio lecture section. It was up to date as of last week.
All right.
Yes.
Online?
Yes. The exam will be online.
How many questions?
32.
Right. And they're just multiple choice?
All of them except for two.
All right.
But one of them is a bonus.
One of them would be a bonus, yes.
I didn't know because you're English for now.
Well, I know. I'm not going to let you look at the exam.
No, I just like the instructions. That's why I was like, is it really one's a bonus question or is that like a previous?
No, that's those are the instructions. I haven't just fixed the dates though.
Okay, yeah, that's fine.
I've done that on purpose. You're welcome. Hello.
You have a nice day.
I will. Take care.